You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 28th. 2022. My name is Sam Seder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dale Kretz, visiting assistant professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, author of Administering Freedom, The State of Emancipation After the Freedmen's Bureau. Also on the program today, massive anti-lockdown protests spreading in China. And Trump welcomes white supremacist Nick Fuentes to dinner. Joe Biden eases Venezuelan sanctions for the winter, one imagines. Major news outlets call for charges versus Julian Assange to be dropped by the U.S. government. Elon Musk now targeting left voices on Twitter. Joe Manchin's permitting side deal looks doomed. Georgia's Saturday early voting numbers were very high. How they break down, we don't know. Houston is on the boil water alert. And Amazon workers in 30 countries stage Black Friday walkouts. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Hope you had a good Thanksgiving holiday. Joining me, of course, back from her, well...
Or whatever.
Break.
Yeah.
Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, and happy birthday to you.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, I heard rumors to that effect, and people are wondering, or I should say, we have a guest to talk about, an element of Reconstruction that we've never talked about. That is a little birthday gift.
Right.
To me.
Gift from Brendan to you.
Yep. Thank you, Brendan. Very much appreciated. This is actually an exciting... An interesting aspect of it, which I think also speaks to sort of there's stuff that's relevant in terms of like a left perspective versus or relative to bureaucracy in today's politics. So, I mean, for me, we are just living, and I think people who've listened to the program for a decent amount of time are aware that I believe we're just living in the wake of a series of F-ups during Reconstruction. And we could be living in a much different country right now if, I guess to a certain extent, maybe Johnson hadn't been vice president, somebody else had been vice president, maybe Lincoln wasn't assassinated, maybe there was a couple more radical Republicans in the Senate and the House. I don't know. But that's that.
Well, we'll explore that soon.
Yes, to celebrate my birthday.
Yes.
Thank you. But let's get on to this. So Nick Fuentes, and well, I'll mention that afterwards. But here is an interview, Asa Hutchinson, one of the rumored potential candidates for the 2024 Republican nomination sweepstakes. Well, I mean, here's the thing. This is the way that it played out in 2016. If we get to where there are more than like three or four, maybe five, including Trump, Republicans who announce their candidacy, you can expect to see over 10. Once we get to like five, if we get to five, you might as well assume that we're going to get over 10, because once there's enough people in there, so that nobody loses to Trump, but instead is one of like just 10 people who didn't win. That's what that's when they'll all get on this, because there is just too much money, too much. It's not, people don't understand, I think, at least in the conventional wisdom media, that the price to pay to run for president, that's done. There is no price to pay, at least in terms of Republicans, if you lose in the presidency.
And look at Joe Biden.
I mean, and well,
right?
Yes, that's true. But he was a sitting senator.
Yeah.
I'm talking like it's not that hard anymore. you can, you know, it's just not that hard to do. There's a lot more fundraising apparatus. And
then it's like a good platform for a book or for, you know, another position in government or in lobbying or whatever.
What exactly? And but here is Asa Hutchinson. And I don't think this guy understands the sort of irony of everything he's saying. They're responding to Trump dining with Nick Fuentes.
You personally prosecuted white supremacist groups. What's your reaction to seeing a former U.S. president associate with someone like that?
Well, I hope someday we won't have to be responding to what former President Trump has said or done. In this instance, it's important to respond. And as you mentioned, the last time I met with a white supremacist, it was in an armed standoff. I had a bulletproof vest on. We arrested them, prosecuted them, sent them to prison. And so, no, I don't think it's a good idea for a leader that's setting an example for the country or the party to meet with avowed racist or anti-Semite. And so it's very troubling, and it shouldn't happen. And we need to avoid those kinds of empowering the extremes. And when you meet with people, you empower. And that's what you have to avoid. You want to diminish their strength, not empower them. Stay away from it.
Trump has released multiple statements. What he's doing is he's denying knowing.
I pause it for one second. I mean, first off, I don't know where this guy's been for the past 40 some odd years. I mean, I don't remember Asa Hutchinson criticizing, let's say, Ronald Reagan going to the Neshoba County Fair to announce that his campaign, when he was running for the, I think it was the general election, was going to be about states' rights, just miles from where you had civil rights workers killed in the struggle for civil rights that became iconic. I mean, literally made a movie about it. And every incident since then, or I don't know if you remember Donald Trump from when he was president or running for president. And the interesting thing you'll note now, and Kevin McCarthy's being smart about this, the first thing that they're doing is not, they're definitely going to get to Hunter Biden and this and that, but the first thing that they're doing is they're talking about impeaching the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas, and investigating the border, because they know that we've got to pivot off of the anti-Semitism and white supremacy that has become so important in our as part of the Republican brand, like Charlottesville.
Yeah, Asa Hutchinson was like lukewarm in his critique on that. By the
way, he doesn't want to go too far.
Yeah.
And but they want to get back to some of their bread and butter stuff. Let's return to the anti-immigration and the xenophobia, where we are much more comfortable being, where we don't have any donors that are going to get upset, that and we don't have to, you know. And so that's what's going on here with Asa Hutchinson, and the idea like we don't have to talk about Donald Trump anymore, dude. The reason why you're on that show is because that you may be running against Donald Trump, period, end of story. I mean, give us a break.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the Republicans are trying to move away from the outright, like, meeting with Holocaust deniers to the just more standard, more palatable form of white supremacy that they engage in regularly.
Diminish their strength, not empower them. Stay away from it.
Trump has released multiple statements. What he's doing is he's denying knowing Nick Fuentes. but he's not condemning his views, let alone condemning Kanye West's history of anti-Semitic comments, recent history. So it's a pattern.
Well, I mean, you can have accidental meetings, things like that happen. This was not an accidental meeting. It was a set-up dinner with Kanye. And so this happened, but you certainly have every occasion that the question of white supremacy or neo-Nazism or denying the Holocaust comes up, you've got to be absolutely clear in your communication that this is not acceptable dogma, it's not acceptable conversation, it's not acceptable history, and you have to disavow it. It is as simple as that, and I'm very proud of the Republican Jewish Coalition, the former ambassador, U.S. ambassador in the Trump administration to Israel has condemned this. And so what Donald Trump did and his failure to condemn it is really the minority of the party. It's the extreme side of it. And that's what you've got to distance yourself from. And he failed to do that.
All right. Let's be clear. The majority of the Republican Party is not the infinitesimally small Jewish Republicans. That's not the majority of the Republican Party. The reason why we're playing this clip is because it is so far and few between where you can find any type of full-throated criticism of Trump hosting Nick Fuentes.
The only reason that Asa Hutchinson is engaging in it is because it's in his self-interest to do so now. That's why he was much more lukewarm when Trump was in power, leader of the party, with Charlottesville saying there's very good people on both sides. Now, hey, he sees some blood in the water, smells it, I should say, running against him. Time to critique.
Yeah, there you go. And so we'll get, you know, some of this for a couple of days, and then they'll forget all about it as if it was completely meaningless. But Donald Trump knows what he's doing. And the Republican Party, you know, again, this is the same complaint they had with Trump 4 years ago, 6 years ago, was he's saying the quiet part loud. And we can't have that. And just as a side note, we've teased some information that we have on Nick Fuentes in the past, and I think we're gonna do a little bit more, make a little bit more of an effort to sort of like dig into this information we have. We had some pretty solid information that would, at the very least, indicate that Fuentes doesn't always practice what he preaches. I'm not sure how to phrase that, but we're going to do a little more digging into this, and we'll make more of an effort to get this information out. You know, in the past we thought like, what was the point of that? But it appears that, you know, the Fuentes is valued it to Donald Trump,
and yeah, so the former president.
Yeah, we'll change our attitude about that. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Dale Kretz, he's visiting professor, assistant professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's written a book, Administering Freedom, the State of Emancipation After the Freedmen's Bureau. We'll be right back after, no, excuse me. We will be with him just after I read some of our sponsors. Got some good news. I don't know if it's in celebration of my birthday.
It should be.
But maybe it is. The Sunset Lake 7-Day Black Friday sale was extended through tonight.
Whoa.
I guess you could say Cyber Monday, but or you could say Cedar Monday. You could do it either way. But the bottom line is, here's how it works. SunsetLakeSebaDay.com is discounting all of their products by 30% with the coupon code FRIDAY. It's not all. Orders over $100 are going to receive a jar of Sebade gummies, a $40 value, for free. I'm not going to lie. During Thanksgiving, one of the ways I managed to get through it, I'm not saying that it's that tumultuous, but it's right, a little bit tumultuous, was the Sunset Lake Sebade gummies. And then as the evening wore on, I moved over to the Sebade with THCA gummies,
very
which
nice,
was fun. Yes. And they are using this opportunity as a fundraising, as a fundraiser for Feeding Chittenden. This is the largest emergency food provider in Vermont. These guys are located up in Burlington. They feed over 12,000 people each year. So Sunset Lake Zebedee is going to donate 10% of this proceeds of this sale to the largest emergency food provider in Vermont. So that's 30% off for you, plus free shipping for orders over $100. I mean, all orders over $100 are going to get a $40 value gummy bears. And on top of that, 10% is going to go towards feeding Chittenden. So this is a great opportunity. If you ever want to try some Sunset Lake Zebedee products, this is the time to do it. And this is coming off the heels of their special during the election day, where we teamed up with them and gave over $5,000 to Planned Parenthood between the two of us. As you know, Sunset Lake Zebedee, it's a majority employee-owned business. It pays a minimum wage of $20 an hour. This past year, like I said, Sunset Lake Zebedee donated over $26,000. Wow. That doesn't even include the Planned Parenthood, to anti-drug war organizations, animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, refugee resettlement, Give Directly. Spoke to them on last Wednesday. Again, visit sunsetlakezebedee.com. Use the coupon code FRIDAY. Take advantage of these deals. The sale ends tonight, 11:59 p.m. Some restrictions may apply. Check it out. Also, a lot of competition to hire people right now. I have said this many times before. The best time to look for someone for work is when you don't need them. So you're not in a panic and you can get a real sense of who the right person is for a job. And are people like that out there? And the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. If you're hiring, you should go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter is how we got Brendan on this program. It was a really, you know, I'm terrified about anything that involves any type of administrative work. And ZipRecruiter made it super easy. It simplifies the whole hiring process. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology. It finds and matches the right candidates up with your job. ZipRecruiter makes it easy to send a personal invite to candidates who seem perfect for your job, so they're more likely to apply. And the best thing for me, ZipRecruiter has an easy-to-use dashboard, has a complete suite of tools, lets you filter, review, rate your candidates all from one place. You can set up the interviews. I mean, it really is super, super convenient. Much better than any type of like weird spreadsheet type of thing that I don't even know how to operate those things. But ZipRecruiter was great. It's a great, it made the process just so much easier and successful. Discovering hiring joy with ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Go to this exclusive web address. Try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. And lastly, does not matter how much you try and prepare for this holiday season, things get a little crazy. You got to go every which way for gifts. You got to, and then all of a sudden, a lot of businesses too. Certainly, businesses who advertise on this program, like, you know, folks like small businesses, going to the post office is a lot trickier if you've got to mail a bunch of stuff. We're probably going to get some snow soon. It's going to be freezing cold.
Busy mailing season. Make it easy on yourself.
Rushing to send cards and gifts to your clients, mm-hmm. or, you know, shipping stuff out from your small business. It is not too late to get your holiday mailing and shipping under control with Stamps.com. Stamps.com, you get access to the U.S. Postal Service and UPS services you need to run your business right from your computer. You can even save money with major discounts on U.S. Postal Service and UPS shipping rates. Up to 86% off. You can print postage wherever you do business. All you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com switch and save feature. You can easily compare carriers and rates. So if you're running an online store, Stamps.com works seamlessly with all the major shopping carts and marketplaces. This holiday season, trade late nights for silent nights and get started with Stamps.com today. Sign up promo code MajorityReport, all one word, for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, enter the code Majority Report. Check it out. All right, quick break. When we come back, Dale Kretz. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, Dale Kretz. He's a visiting assistant professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The author of Administrating Freedom, The State of Emancipation After the Freedmen's Bureau. Dale, thanks for joining us on the program. As a birthday present to me, we are talking about some element of Reconstruction. Always one of my favorite topics to talk about. So, really glad that you could be here for this. This is a really interesting a perspective on, or I guess, lens in which to take a look at Reconstruction and why slash how it failed, as opposed to sort of like the political aspects of it. Although this is, you know, I don't know that you can fully divorce this aspect, but the administrative ability to fulfill, I guess, the promise of Reconstruction. Yeah. So let's just start first with, like, give us a general context of, like, what the federal government's capacity was, not just in the context of fulfilling, you know, Reconstruction, but just broadly speaking. Like, you know, we had no income tax at that time. Like, give us a sense of, like, what was the federal government capable of doing, I guess, entering into the Civil War and then, you know, sort of afterwards?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So before the Civil War, the national government did not have that great a presence in the lives of ordinary Americans, be they citizens or subjects. The growth of the federal government was a product of the Civil War, not a prelude to it. And we see this especially with the federal intervention during the Civil War. This requires, on the Union's part, a massive mobilization of resources and a massive aggrandizement of federal authority in order to, you know, fully marshal all of the resources necessary to defeat the rebellion in the South. And so this, you know, military buildup also accompanied an administrative buildup. And the creation, really, for the first time, of a sizable administrative state. Scholars like to talk about a Yankee Leviathan that emerges during the Civil War and continues after the Civil War to really structure the American political economy from the top down. And generally, that's one of the two stories that, you know, historians of Reconstruction have told. The story of the growth of the central state, the, you know, new northern image of the political economy being imposed on the nation as a whole, and, you know, the inauguration of the Gilded Age. That's generally one story of Reconstruction that's centered in the North. And the second story is typically a story that is centered in the South. It's a story of the destruction of slavery. It's a story of the rise of Jim Crow. And these two stories generally don't ever intersect in the historiography. So one effort that I make in the book is to tie these two stories together to show how the 4 million emancipated men, women, and children were actually critical actors in the building of the administrative state. They shaped it and they challenged it at every turn and really tried to wring from it a, you know, rapidly diminishing promise of emancipation, which looked very, very different in the Crucible of War than it would by the end of the century.
All right, and before we move on to, like, those visions of what emancipation means, I get, okay, so the expansion of authority, that seems like it's not hard for me to intuit like what that may have meant. We have the ability to, to take these goods here, or to, you know, your farm is going to be a place where you're going to house some Union soldiers for a period of time, or we're going to need your ships to bring our soldiers down the river. Like, we've expanded our authority there, and in terms of like the non-military sort of like bureaucracy, like what would have been created? Like, I guess maybe like we need procurement for uniforms. And so there has to be something built out there that isn't directly military, but how does it look? Were there new departments created? Were there new cabinet secretaries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Pension Bureau had existed before. It was established in the 1830s, and during the Civil War in 1862, lawmakers realized that they could no longer administer pensions the way that they had before. And you know, this story really underscores the relationship between the wartime state and the welfare state. So the need for the Union to, you know, take care of its, you know, soldiers, its injured soldiers, its, you know, widows, its orphans. This was, you know, a widely understood need that the, you know, federal government had during the Civil War. And so it really had to, you know, embark on a new institutional way to administer social welfare to, you know, these most deserving of recipients, you know, Union veterans and their dependents.
And to be clear, the existence of the Pension Bureau was always about people who had, it was always about vets, essentially.
Generally, yeah. And so this really began, I mean, the national government and state governments began paying pensions to Revolutionary War veterans first, and these programs generally expanded to include their widows, and then more lateral ties of dependency and more, you know, vertical ties of dependency as well. Increasing liberality is how scholars generally describe the growth of the pension system. And this liberality really, you know, catapults during the Civil War beyond all previous recognition. It doesn't just expand, it also becomes institutionalized in a way that, you know, was rather unpredictable and rather unstoppable, such that by the end of the 19th century, the payment of pensions to Union veterans and heirs consumed well over a third of the federal budget. I mean, this is a massive chunk of federal expenditures going to pensions. And that created its own set of political struggles between, you know, Republicans who designed the pension program and administered it as, you know, faithfully as they could, and the, you know, reactionary Democrats who objected to any sort of, you know, federal largesse, particularly when it's on behalf of Union veterans, their families, and veterans of the U.S. Colored Troops as well. So this is always a political struggle, even though it was, you know, embedded in this emerging, you know, administrative state, which, you know, many people regard as beyond the grasp or the glimpse of the general population.
Is the Pension Bureau the only, you know, entering into the war and maybe just coming directly, well, entering into the war before we get into like any type of the Reconstruction legislation, is that really the only, or I mean, clearly it was the primary if it's a third of the budget, but was it the only sort of mechanism the federal government had to deliver benefits to Americans? I mean, you know, I imagine there may have been other sort of like narrow subsets of Americans, but was there, you know, agrarian subsidies or maybe some support for farming? What was there anything else or that? Was it just like one third is pensions for people who served in the war? The other two thirds are more or less to wage war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were other efforts, especially during the war itself, so-called domestic efforts that the, you know, Republican-dominated Congress was able to pass without any Democratic opposition to speak of, really. So the prime example here would be the Homestead Act of 1862, which was a Republican plan to open the West for, you know, white settlement. And this afforded, you know, families, white families who were willing to move West a plot of land that they could buy from the government for incredibly cheap. And they could expect to have their homesteads defended by the might of the, you know, federal army. So this was one of, you know, several positive endeavors, you could say, in the sense that it's not, you know, taking away, it's, you know, trying to build something and expand something. And it was pioneered during the Civil War. There were, you know, antecedents to it, but nothing on the scale that we see during the war itself. Again, this is a responsibility that the national government undertook. Different state governments had different programs for, you know, encouraging one sort of social phenomenon or another. There were different programs for redress or, you know, reparations on an individual scale, but nothing like the, you know, massive social welfare programs that you see inaugurated during and, you know, for decades after the Civil War. The Civil War really was the catalyst for the new way of thinking about what the federal government was capable of doing.
Catalog for us, to the extent that you can, the various visions of what it would mean to free the slaves, you know, I guess entering into the Civil War. You know, it ranges from we're going to free the enslaved, and then we're going to ship them to Africa, to certain measures of integration, and then I would imagine also like, and also we're going to make sure that these people become full citizens. It's not enough, you know. There's a difference between, well, you're no longer enslaved, and then you're a full citizen. I mean, that's a different a state of being. Will you catalog for us those different visions and who may have represented them, or what political forces may have represented those different visions?
It's a great question, and it's one of the, you know, prime questions of the antebellum period. It's one of the major reasons why emancipatory projects weren't enacted. The vision of what a post-slavery United States would look like. And there were many different competing visions as well. So ranging from the, you know, conservative, which you had mentioned, the colonization plans to, you know, deport, newly freed, men, women, and children, you know, quote unquote, back to Africa. That was entertained by, you know, many Republicans on the right. There were other programs which would essentially mimic the British example in the West Indies of inaugurating a kind of apprenticeship system whereby the, you know, newly emancipated wouldn't be free, fully. They wouldn't be, you know, fully accorded the rights of citizenship, as you also mentioned, but instead they would enter into a period of apprenticeship for, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, whereby they continue working for their ex-enslavers, except for a wage this time, with certain, you know, regulatory apparatuses, organizing, you know, conduct between former enslavers and the formerly enslaved. Again, that was also a more conservative vision. The more radical visions, which were, you know, voiced by the abolitionists, by black abolitionists in particular, did entail not just a full undoing of the slavers' regime, but also the immediate inauguration of citizenship rights for the formerly enslaved, as well as, you know, voting rights, and above all, more than anything else, land, the redistribution of land held by enslavers. And there was a lot of land to speak of. During the Civil War, the radical Thaddeus Stevens in the House of Representatives identified 70,000 arch traders, as he called them, which had, I think, 400 million acres of land. And he proposed to seize this land and redistribute it to, you know, some 800,000 black families, which would have been more than enough for, you know, 40 acres for each family. I think each family would have gotten a 500-acre tract if that vision had been enacted. So there are, as you said, a lot of different competing visions of what the post-slavery world would look like, ranging from the conservative to the more radical, which was, again, voiced by abolitionists, radicals, and especially black abolitionists.
And we should say arch traders in the sense that they're not trading things, but they were traitors to the United States. They were rebels in that sense.
Exactly.
All right. And one more question on this before we move forward. How much, because I'm fascinated by the idea that we see time and time again in moments like these, and across this, you know, it's really, I guess, intellectual history. But it's also very political in the sense that how developed were these different visions, and how much were the development of these different visions did that play a part in whether they got executed? Mm. Right. I mean, we see that, does that make sense? Like, you know, we see this all the time where, you know, the right has been always very good, at least in this modern era, of like, if we elect somebody, we've got a list of, you know, 12 justices that we want. Or if we elect, we're going to pull these different policies off the shelf and we're going to implement them. They're all just tax cuts. But, you know, it's been my experience that the left doesn't do that as much. But you can also see this dynamic. You know, I studied religious studies. You know, people have a vision of like, this is what this, it's this religion. If, you know, they get kicked out of the temple, then this will take prominence because it'll be more suited towards a non-temple based religion type of situation. Like, how developed were these different visions, and how much after the war were the development of those visions predictive as to what we got?
Yeah, that's a great question. So how were these different ideologies planned? How were they operationalized as well? I mean, in some respects, the Civil War caught a lot of radicals by surprise. I mean, they had wished for a rebellion so that they could use the federal government to swiftly emancipate all of the enslaved, which, you know, didn't happen as swiftly as they had wanted, but nevertheless it happened. And so many who had been thinking about what a post-emancipation South and United States would look like were sort of caught off guard in one way or another. But we see them, you know, scrambling during the war itself to operationalize their visions. And they were improvising in many ways. They didn't have necessarily a set blueprint that they would propose on the floor and debate on the floor. Instead, it was rather, you know, developed on the fly in response to on-the-ground conditions, which varied widely across the 750,000 square miles of the wartime South. And we see this especially, I think most pronounced, in the struggle over the creation of the Freedmen's Bureau, which was passed on March 3rd, 1865, in the waning days of the war. And the main struggle was between radicals like Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner, who wanted to house the so-called Emancipation Bureau in the Treasury Department. More conservative Republicans wanted to house it in the War Department, and they won out. And this debate mattered a great deal because whether it was housed in the War or Treasury Department would signal the permanence of that institution. If it was in the War Department, then it was temporary. It was a wartime measure set to expire when the war expired. If it was in the Treasury Department, like the radicals wanted, this would be a more permanent feature. You would have this, you know, first federal endeavor and social welfare on the behalf of the recently emancipated, you know, embedded in the, you know, federal state for many years to come. It wouldn't be, you know, tethered to the continuance of the, you know, slaveholders' rebellion. And so again, the radicals lost out there, and a number of other conservative elements sort of ate away at the, you know, grander, more radical vision of the radicals for the Freedmen's Bureau. Above all, the, you know, initial charter that the Bureau had to redistribute to the formerly enslaved all of the lands that had been acquired during the Civil War, because the, you know, enslavers either abandoned that land or the U.S. Army took it by force. The Army had a great deal of land by, you know, the dawn of 1865, and the question was what to do with it. The land was effectively nationalized, and so having this land was a way to basically allow these different visions of emancipation to take root. This was a sort of blank canvas, more or less blank canvas, on which different, you know, abolitionist-minded politicians could paint their picture. And we see different projects enacted during the war, and eventually, you know, a different federal consensus on what that particular agency would look like, and it came in the form of the Freedmen's Bureau.
Yeah, I found that like that you writing about that distinction between where it ends up was to me sort of like almost the whole ball game on some level. Like, you know, everything that happens after that is in many ways, it feels like almost predetermined. Once you make that first decision, we're going to put it in the War Department as opposed to the Treasury. And where did the land that the army conquers, let's say, who's in charge of that? Like, I get the army, we need to administer it right now, but on whose books is that, who keeps the ledger? We've got this land. It's the United States' land at this point. Where is that? There's no, you know, land. We don't have a Bureau of Land Management at that point. Who's got the books on that land?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, and it really depended. The possession of the land was one thing, but the legal possession of it was another, and these were not, you know, strict categories. If, you know, the federal government claimed it via the U.S. Army because a rebel planter abandoned it, they didn't necessarily have title deed to it. And with Andrew Johnson's pardon, he essentially invited those former enslavers and, you know, ex-planters back onto their lands with, you know, general amnesty. And the question is, you know, who was running these plantations during the war? On some plantations, you have, you know, military officials running it, paying wages to the formerly enslaved, now, you know, not quite citizens, but, you know, not quite enslaved, you know, in sort of like liminal space. You'd have military officials running these plantations. On other plantations, you had the federal government essentially selling it to northern lessees. So you'd have northern businessmen believing in this, you know, free labor ideology that they could run a plantation better than the slaveholders, and they would come down. Many of them came down during the Civil War to buy land from the federal government on the cheap and essentially, you know, try and enact their free labor visions, believing that if you pay workers, you know, wages, even small wages, they'll work harder than if you threaten them with violence like the slaveholders did. And so there's, you know, a widespread class of northern planters that come down during the war. And this was another way in which the federal government was trying to finance the Civil War in the middle of the Civil War by selling these lands, by collecting, you know, revenue from the sale of cotton on these northern run, you know, military backed plantations. And for the freed people having to work it, this was a really dismal view of what freedom would look like, right? They essentially regarded this as a form of quasi-slavery. They found that their northern, you know, employers could be just as harsh as their southern slave masters. They imposed all sorts of rules. They, you know, had curfew. They begged the army to allow them to enact corporal punishment on their, you know, workers. And, you know, this was a system that, you know, rubbed many formerly enslaved men and women the wrong way. And they, you know, seized upon this as further evidence that they are entitled to own that land themselves. They knew that if they had to work land that was owned by somebody else, be they, you know, southern former slaveholder or northern businessman turned planter, that they were not truly free. Land ownership was the central tenet of Black freedom. That was what they held on to doggedly for many years, and they believed, many of them believed, that there was going to be widespread land redistribution come January 1st, 1865. And many were, you know, sorely disappointed that that didn't come to pass, and that the Freedmen's Bureau, which they believed was the vehicle, the instrument to actually redistribute these lands and give, you know, freed people titles to the land, that you know, initial promise was diminished. It was bankrupt. It was, you know, stolen, and they no longer were able to claim land in any sort of, you know, legal sense. It was only a moral claim that they could make, and they did make it, you know, through the turn of the century into the 20th century.
It's just amazing to imagine if that had happened at that time, which is not to say that we don't have evidence of how it could be reversed. I mean, certainly we had, you know, what amounts to pogroms in various states around the country where there was sort of Black wealth and Black political power developed. But if that political power and wealth was rooted in widespread ownership of land, it becomes a lot harder to have those sort of like isolated moments, and the federal government has to respond more to these people because they have more political power. And it's a, you know, it's almost like a once and done type of situation that would have, you know, more likely than not had created a trajectory that would have really fundamentally changed where this country would be today in terms of like just politics and the questions of race and so what did happen with the Freedmen Bureau? How did the bureaucratic operations of it inhibit this? And how do you distinguish between the political will that existed in the sort of like political, strictly political arena from bureaucratic obstacles? And how much were those bureaucratic obstacles influenced by a lack of political will?
Yeah, it's definitely a vicious cycle there. So it's partly a question of, political will, partly a question of, you know, ideological vision, partly a question of state capacity. And all of these things really intermixed and resulted in a Freedmen's Bureau that was, you know, manifestly incapable of executing any sort of will in any consistent manner. I mean, to start with funding. So the Freedmen's Bureau, the amount of funding it received for the 7 years of its existence was equivalent to what the Union government spent executing the war for one day. That was the amount of money that was given to the Freedmen's Bureau for 7 years. It was wildly understaffed, spread across a massive territory.
One day of war?
One day executing the war.
Wow.
So that shows you, you know, where priorities lay. The Union government was dedicated to winning the war, but not necessarily winning the peace for, you know, the formerly enslaved men, women, and children in the South. This was, you know, one of the primary hurdles, and the lack of funding, the lack of, you know, staffing and manpower, the withdrawal of the U.S. Army from the South in the early 1870s really prevented the Bureau from being anything but a kind of, you know, federal figurehead, just a kind of vestige of authority. These, you know, scattered Freedmen's Bureau outposts across the South could do little more than, you know, manage contracts that, you know, came in front of them. It could report on, you know, white terrorist violence that gripped the South, but it didn't really have the power to enforce anything. And it could have been different. It would have taken, you know, more money to begin with. It would have taken a greater plan. It would have taken more of a political will in Congress. And there was, you know, something of a strong will at the beginning, at least when it was founded, at least when the radicals in Congress took over the Reconstruction Project from President Johnson, who was, you know, very much sympathetic to former slaveholders and, you know, vehemently hated freed people. There was ways in which, you know, the Freedmen's Bureau could have been more robust, and it simply wasn't. It didn't have the money, it didn't have the manpower. And so by the end, by 1872, when it officially closed its doors, all it was doing was, you know, running a few hospitals, running a few schools, you know, reviewing a few labor contracts. And most importantly for my work, it was fulfilling the claims, the bounty and pension claims of men who had served in the USCT, as well as their dependents. This was one function that it could do. And it speaks to the, you know, rather dramatic constricting of what the Freedmen's Bureau was capable of doing, but also what, you know, freedom meant. It would not mean, you know, inclusion in a large state powerful enough to make your rights felt and meaningful. Instead, what the federal government via the Freedmen's Bureau was capable of doing was fulfilling individual claims, means testing individual entitlements, and maybe getting, you know, very stringent, benefits delivered to, you know, a handful of the 4 million, freed people it was intended to serve. And so it's a real blow, to the Black freedom struggle. And they recognize it, like on the ground, they saw how embattled the Freedmen's Bureau was. They saw it diminishing before their very eyes, and they mobilized to fight it, but they could only do so much from their positions of, you know, dramatic disempowerment.
What I mean, how much of that was just simply at the time there wasn't the how conscious was, or I mean, I guess let's talk about the struggle to set it up, because it is again another one of those things where it's like, you know, you can predict what's going to happen in the future by how you set it up in that moment and where its funding comes from, whose auspices it is. Is it, I mean, because we can look at things like Social Security. We can look at things like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, like the way that it was set up, where its funding doesn't come from Congress. So it sort of has a quasi independence that Congress, you know, a hostile Congress can't shut it down in the way that it could maybe, you know, attack like the IRS for that matter or something. What were the key features that made it? Was it just simply like, you guys have 7 years to do this, or was there some other like mechanism to tie to term limited, and was its funding tied in a certain way that it was specifically, you know, there was a ticking time bomb associated with it? Like what were the intricacies of the way that it was set up that made it sort of set up to fail?
It was designed to run on its own revenue, essentially. So it had to pay for itself, not just in terms of, you know, the sort of bare bones financing of it, but also ideologically. Democrats hated the Freedmen's Bureau, and Republicans, you know, were tired of the Freedmen's Bureau being a lightning rod of political conflict. They were tired of, you know, the Freedmen's Bureau essentially being the Reconstruction Project writ small. Right. So they had to, you know, vigorously defend the Freedmen's Bureau against all sorts of charges that, you know, this was an unconstitutional intervention in the South, in the, you know, post-war South, because, you know, the rebel armies had surrendered. There's no reason why this wartime agency should still be in existence. There's no reason why there should be, you know, a federal welfare agency set up to take care of a particular class of, you know, individuals. We wouldn't say citizens just yet.
So there's the war. I mean, the wartime thing, that's where we see the relevance of it being in the War Department as opposed into being into Treasury, because that's one reason why you attack it. Why do we need it? The war is over.
Definitely. Yeah. So its funds did not come from elsewhere. It had to be self-generating, self-supporting in a way in order to ward off charges of fraud, but especially dependency, right? So there's a widespread fear, even among Republicans, that the formerly enslaved, even recently removed from slavery just months prior, would become quote unquote dependent on the federal government. They wouldn't want to work. They would just want to receive, you know, welfare benefits from the federal government. That was the fear.
So in other words, the safety net would become a hammock.
Essentially, yeah.
That's the thing, is that this none of this dynamic, you know, this the same thing we're hearing 200 some odd years later. And so what was the statutory authority they had to raise money? Like, what was the mechanism in which, you know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau does it from bank fees? And they have a statutory authority to collect certain bank fees, and that's the way they finance their operations, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what was the Freedom Bureau's, the Freedmen's Bureau's statutory authority to collect money?
Well, I mean, the largest resource that it had was confiscated lands. So those nationalized lands that it had in its authority, nominally at least, that was its primary source of revenue, right? So because it had to fund its own operations, and because it had all of this land, it essentially sold it back to, you know, anyone who would buy it. It sold it back to planters. It, you know, returned it to planters. Only in some cases was, you know, the land basically given to you know, select, you know, formerly enslaved families on like the Georgia and South Carolina Lowcountry who were able to, you know, produce and, you know, maintain some small hold. But by and large, you know, it was land. It was its own land that the Freedmen's Bureau used in order to finance its operations and to try and ward off charges of dependency and excess and, you know, unconstitutional continuance of this wartime agency. So it was really, you know, hamstrung from the beginning, and it was a real, you know, self-inflicted wound as well. And all of it goes back to, as you were saying, its, you know, initial charter, the initial, you know, situation of the Freedmen's Bureau in the War Department instead of the Treasury Department, a more permanent agency where its funding can come from an external source or from, like, general taxation, and it would be more insulated from political attacks. But in fact, it wasn't. In fact, this first federal experiment in social welfare really set the stage for, you know, this very peculiar American combination of anti-black racism and anti-statism. That is, you know, the sort of, you know, crux of the American assault on social welfare programs. It didn't just begin in the 1960s or the 1930s. It was the 1860s that you really see the roots of this, you know, racist attack on social welfare provisioning.
I mean, that's where the whole states' rights thing, right? You don't want the federal government to come in and tell us how we're going to operate. And when people talk about the sort of failure of Reconstruction, it really was like a function of half measures that didn't fundamentally sort of say, like, you've lost. You're going to now, like, for the next 5 or 10 years, you're going to be in the role of a essentially like a land that has been, for lack of better term, conquered or defeated, and you're going to reorient yourself in such a way. And that never happened. And we live with that, the implications of that today. I want to return back to just sort of the lessons about that bureaucracy for today, particularly for those of us on the left, because really these bureaucracies and these agencies exist only for people who are looking to have government function for people, right? I mean, it's like almost like fundamentally a left project, except for maybe elements of the national security state, which are to sort of inhibit democracy in some way. But before we get there, I want to talk about like what was happening with, because you write about the populist movement that took place there, and the sort of and we've touched on this in the past on this program, like in the context of I think it was what was happening in North Carolina, South Carolina, and the ways of which the white people were trying to remove black political power by appealing to populists who were like, we don't really care about the racism as much as we care about the fact that you guys are really wealthy and not sharing any of that money. Talk briefly about what happened with the black, with the populist movement and the attempt to sort of bridge to create a bridge with recently unenslaved people, I guess, as a political project, and how that collapsed.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. So the populist movement, especially in the late 19th century, is one of the more understudied phenomena in American political history, and especially the populist movement in the South, which really began in the 1880s. It sort of sprang from different like farmers associations and farmers collectives, white and black. They were generally segregated. But there was, you know, widespread agrarian unrest, owing to, you know, falling cotton prices and so forth in the 1870s and the 1880s. And so these different like farmers collectives sprang up, and they essentially provided the kind of seedbed for what would later become the populist movement, you know, embodied in the People's Party. And in the South, you know, we have essentially a democratic state that was, you know, taken over during Reconstruction, when you have Republican state governments. The Democrats were able to take it over. And so there's a kind of, you know, two-party stasis in the South, with the Democrats basically, you know, having a stranglehold on all seats of power. What the populist movement did in the South was, you know, rattle that two-party system. The populists presented a major challenge to the political establishment in a way that was, you know, seldom glimpsed before or since. And again, in the South in particular, the formerly enslaved, you know, black Southerners were not yet disenfranchised. That would not start happening until 1890. So in the 1880s, you have this, you know, rather remarkable political period between Reconstruction and the end of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow, when black people were still voting in sizable numbers, able to tip elections in many counties. Yep. And so populists, you know, rather savvily appealed to black voters. And black populists really took the initiative in mobilizing the black vote on behalf of, you know, favored candidates that would listen to the demands of farmers, black and white alike. And so there was a great deal of synthesis between the white populists of the South and the black populists. But as you mentioned, it always foundered on the issue of race. Right? So black populists were far more interested in issues of civil rights, anti-lynching legislation, and so forth, than white populists were. They both shared an economic vision, but in terms of a social vision, white populists didn't want to rock the boat with, you know, pushing for civil rights or the federal oversight of elections. And ultimately, that lack of a bridge over, you know, social and civil issues was really what destroyed the populist movement in the South. And we see it eventually captured by the Democratic Party in the mid-1890s. But there was a remarkable moment, as I said, where things could have turned out very differently. It could have been a more, you know, populist-inflected political landscape, especially in the South and the West, where the populists were most strong.
And to be clear, when you say captured by the Democratic Party, that the capture from in terms of like identifying and in terms of like working into the apparatus of the party followed an ideological sort of like almost virus, if you will, through the populace where they became increasingly racist. Right. I mean, and it was coming. I mean, the Democrats were racist at that time, too. And so that's where it came. But the folding into the Democratic Party was a second order issue from the racial resent. Yeah. And I think this is important because this is like the story that keeps coming up in American politics. You know, The Hammer and the Hoe is a book that we've discussed on this program, like in the 20s, where there was an attempt to build a working class solidarity between black communists and it was Robin Kelly, black communists and white working people. And again, this falls apart because of, I don't know if it's just like a pure racist ideology or if it's just because you have, and you know, it's so obvious when you're 15 years out from 4 million people being enslaved, like how do you have a political movement that is not going to involve their material interests being redress the things that made us slaves, right? Like right. Both economically, but also in terms of like civil rights, like the right to vote, like the right to be recognized as a human being, the right to not have our family separated. Like that's going to be on your mind 15 years out from slavery, 20 years out from slavery. I would argue even 100 years out from slavery, maybe more, you know, and there was just an incredible reluctance or at least a palpable, incredible reluctance or at least a palpable tendency to ignore those being legitimate material yeah. interests for your partners there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, the Democratic establishment during the 1890s, it really race baited and red baited the populists to death. It painted the populists of the 1890s as, you know, essentially the Republican Party of the 1850s. And black voters sort of made that association as well. They said, you know, the Populist Party today, the People's Party today, is essentially like what the Abolitionist Party of the 1850s was to us back then. It's now going to deliver us from political bondage, which was a phrase that they often used. And so, you know, increasingly in the South, you had, you know, populists being the only party that was appealing to black voters. Sometimes even, you know, running black voters for office. Even the Republican Party in the South after Reconstruction enforced what was called the Lily White policy. You know, they would only support white people for office. And this was the party that was supposed to be, you know, the closest in, you know, allegiance to the formerly enslaved. And so we really see, you know, a coordinated assault from the political establishment targeting populists as radicals and as, you know, essentially the party of black domination. And yes, eventually, you know, a number of white populists, key white populists, you know, caved. And the Democratic Party agreed to, you know, nominally accept a few of their demands into their, you know, Democratic Party platform, basically, you know, paying lip service to agrarian unrest. And with that, you know, it destroyed the Populist Party, and Jim Crow could finally be inaugurated. This is another very important aspect of this period in history, which is often forgotten. Jim Crow only was able to be instituted at the state level across the South after the defeat of the populist insurgency. The first state to inaugurate a Jim Crow system statewide was Mississippi in 1890. It didn't have a populist threat. It could call for a state constitutional convention to rewrite the Constitution without worrying about populists taking over the convention and rewriting that to their ends. The next state was South Carolina in 1895. Still, there were populists active in 1895, not so much in South Carolina. The other states had to wait until their populist threat was neutralized in order to call for a state convention to inaugurate Jim Crow. So really, it's not until the crushing of the populist movement that we see the full instantiation of, you know, what we would recognize today as a Jim Crow system in the South. You know, the Populist Party was a sort of last gasp at, you know, staving off, you know, a sort of, you know, straight up racist society in the South for, you know, generations.
So let's, I want to talk about like sort of lessons that we get to today. And we should say that you're, in addition to being a historian, you are a union organizer for the Nurses Union in California, which is one of the most, I mean, I think radical or active unions in the country, more or less. And so I want to talk about like sort of the lessons that we can learn, A, from what we were just talking about, like the because this is something that has been roiling the progressive left and it has been this sort of, do we get bogged down, you know, like, you know, material interests versus like, I guess, civil rights. On some level, there's this sort of like false dichotomy, or I perceive it as a false dichotomy that is brought up in some sectors of the left. And the lessons that I take from like what happened to the populace was, is that you cannot abandon the civil rights agenda, because without it, you simply do not have, you're ignoring what are the legitimate material interests of such a wide sector of who's going to make up a genuine left in this country.
Right. Yeah. And the California Nurses Association, which is the union that I work for as a labor representative. I mean, we are, you know, a militant trade union, and we are a social movement, and we take very seriously racial justice. We recognize that racial justice is integral to workers' rights. You can't have one without the other. And the lessons of that association are clear if you, you know, look back at American history in the 20th century or even, you know, in the 19th century as we've been discussing today. So, you know, foregrounding racial justice and social justice, this is all, you know, incredibly important to actually giving workers greater democracy in the workplace and to expand those rights beyond the workplace to the nation at large. I mean, when we're talking about, you know, one of the primary political goals of, you know, the nurses union, that's, you know, Medicare for all. It's single payer healthcare, taking, you know, this vital public function outside of market imperatives and, you know, using that as a kind of, you know, way to build a more robust social welfare state that takes care of everybody, you know, without qualification, without condition, you know, free at the point of service. You know, again, insulating it from market imperatives, from privatization, and from means testing. Really, the only way to accomplish, you know, that feat and to really liberate people from the market in a very like human flesh and blood sense, is to have, you know, single payer healthcare.
All right. Well, I want to get to that in terms of like the left's perspective on bureaucracy. But when you say that social justice is integral to delivering for a working class movement, is that on as a political matter in terms of like a movement building matter, or in terms of like an agenda matter, or is it both? And and can you address those separately? Because as a political matter, it seems like, you know, like I think people are like, well, I can't understand it as a as an agenda matter. You know, where it's like too hard for people to, you know, how do I reconcile, like, what if it's a universal program, then what difference does it make if it's black or white people who get it at that point? But and to me, it's like, I think it's a much easier sort of like obvious, like as a political matter, like there's just not enough. Mm-hmm. Like if you want working class power, you have to address the social justice aspect of a tremendous amount of working class people in this country, because it, their set of agenda there is longstanding, and there's just this incredible sort of like history in this country of like for them to have political power it involves like what we call social justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean the key to it isn't, you know, targeted and means tested social programs, because those make, you know, rather easy targets, and they never deliver benefits the way that you would expect them to deliver benefits. And sometimes they're, you know, cynically used by those in the center to basically pay lip service to issues of social justice and to, you know, tout their own, you know, bona fides in terms of, you know, being able to recognize marginalized groups and give them, you know, targeted programs, which, you know, essentially amount to more or less, you know, tax deductions. And that's not a way to build, you know, empowered citizens. You build empowered citizens with policies that are universal. Universal policies will disproportionately help those who have been disproportionately harmed. And, you know, as a point of, you know, organizing, you need to organize across, you know, all of these artificial lines that have been created by, you know, the capitalist class to divide workers against themselves and to distract from the larger project of workplace, you know, organizing, workplace justice, and workplace democracy. And so, you know, as a point of organizing, you know, you need to overcome those, you know, artificial and imposed social barriers in order to, you know, actually get these, you know, programs enacted. And these programs, again, as I've said, you know, need to be universal. Everybody in, nobody out. That's the only way that you can actually, you know, fully redistribute benefits and to not have these sorts of programs targeted in the same way, you know, or at least in a similar way that, you know, people targeted these particular agencies in the 1860s and 70s for, you know, only intervening on behalf of one particular class of citizens. Like there needs to be a more, you know, permanent, universal and comprehensive program that benefits everybody. That's the only way to actually achieve, you know, justice, and especially justice for workers, the vast majority of the population.
Let's talk about the lessons that you see in terms of like the left's relationship to the bureaucracy, right? Like we know what the right's relationship to the bureaucracy is. We don't want it unless it really involves like the national security state or the military, the police. That's it. You know, all done because we want business to be able to do whatever it can at the, you know, basically externalize its costs to society, maybe different cohorts of society or just society at large or to the environment or whatnot. And then, we keep all the profits, and that's the way we create a bigger profit margin. But what is to the extent that there's a left critique of, is there a left critique of bureaucracy, or is there a left critique of the execution in certain circumstances of bureaucracy? I mean, this is sort of to me, it's like where people say, like, I am against regulation. What? How you can be against regulation? Like, I'm not for, just because I'm pro regulation doesn't mean I'm pro every regulation, right? Like, will you just sort of parse that out a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question. Is there a left critique of bureaucracy? Well, certainly not on the scale of...
Or should there even be a left critique of bureaucracy writ large versus specific bureaucracies, like specific execution of bureaucracy?
Yeah, yeah, that's a really provocative question. I mean, I think that there should be a you know, broad left critique of bureaucracy, and it should acknowledge the right critique of bureaucracy, which is essentially, you know, sabotaging these, you know, administrative agencies from the inside and then pointing at them and saying, look how terrible they are. I think we need to privatize all of them. Like that's been the right sort of, you know, approach to, you know, defanging and declawing any sort of, you know, bureaucracy outside the punitive ones.
Post office to Social Security to IRS. I mean, we just see it on and on and on. FDA, I mean, everything.
Medicare, Medicaid. I mean, yeah, that's how they undermine those social policies. And the left really hasn't had an answer. They say, yeah, you know, bureaucracy is bad. Yeah, it's frustrating, but, you know, we should just keep it around. It's very weak. It's very, you know, room temperature. And I think a robust left critique, which, you know, I think this book, you know, contributes to, at least in a historical sense, the beginning of a kind of left critique of bureaucracy, that ought to be rooted in our vision of a, you know, universal social welfare state, that in fact, you know, means testing and privatization is what expands the bureaucracy. It's what gives administrators and bureaucrats greater power and discretion and control over our lives. It's what produces beleaguered subjects instead of empowered citizens. You can only have empowered citizens when they have, you know, positive experiences with the state, especially when it comes to things like, you know, healthcare or other forms of social welfare. There shouldn't be, you know, mountains of paperwork to fill out in order to get benefits, right? You shouldn't have to. If you're an ordinary American, you shouldn't have to really ever talk to a federal bureaucrat. Like that should be the ideal, right? The administrative burden should be on the administration itself or on employers, right? And that's when you're talking about regulations. You know, we still need regulations and we still need administrative agencies to regulate things like, you know, the EPA. But the burden should not be on individual workers. It should be on employers to comply with those regulations. You know, most Americans aren't employers. They're employees. They're workers. And so they would not really be harmed by increased regulations or an expanded regulatory state. What they are harmed by is the punitive apparatus of the, you know, federal government, the NSA, the police state. These institutions are how most Americans encounter the federal government in a punitive sense. In a sort of, you know, mundane administrative sense, we're talking about, you know, frustrating, you know, programs like the DMV or, you know, other bureaucracies that we encounter really on a daily basis and that shapes our lives and shapes our experience of government and our sense of what government is there for, right? It's not there for us necessarily. It's there to, you know, hold us in suspicion. It's there to frustrate us. It's there to keep us from, you know, receiving, you know, meager benefits.
How is that articulated? First off, let me just say, like, I think the DMV gets a bad rap. Honestly, like, I 90% of my experiences with the DMV have been positive.
I don't mean to pick on that in particular.
Let me just say that. But putting that aside, like, how do we articulate that in an elevator pitch in terms of a bureaucracy? Is it, we don't want any bureaucracy that involves individualizing benefits from the government is wrong, but any bureaucracy that is set up to provide universal benefits is right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it would have to acknowledge the harms of means testing and privatization, both of which, you know, were forecasted in the 1860s with the Freedmen's Bureau and the Freedmen's Branch, which has been totally forgotten, right. And the Pension
Bureau. Freedmen's Branch, we should just say, is the sort of like the diminished Freedmen's Bureau.
It continued the work of the Freedmen's Bureau for another 7 years until 1879, basically just fulfilling claims. So that was, the last remaining work of the Freedmen's Bureau, and it lasted well beyond. And, you know, it affected the lives of, you know, thousands of formerly enslaved men, women, and children. And, you know, it's just been totally lost to history. I write about it for the first time in my book, and it's an example of, you know, how Americans generally don't like to think about bureaucracy or remember it or, you know, give it any sort of, you know, sustained analysis or critique. And, you know, we've done that essentially to our peril, especially on the latter half of the 20th century to today. Like, we don't, it's why we're asking these very questions. How should the left talk about bureaucracy?
That's my fear.
Program by now.
That's my fear with like a blanket rejection of bureaucracy by the left is that it falls into that same trap of like a blanket regulation, you know, regulatory state. Like, you know, it becomes a critique of government, which I think is like, you know, is the wrong tact for the left. It's got to be a more sort of like nuanced, it doesn't have to be nuanced per se, but it has to be more exact. And because government is the mechanism in which we have, a communitarian programs. I mean, that's it. It is supposed to be at its best the manifestation of our needs and desires for what we want for society.
Absolutely. And, you know, as a sort of, you know, vision for what a left, you know, argument for bureaucracy would look like, we could just look to the experiences that, you know, the formerly enslaved had with, you know, their own federal officials. You know, they recognized the necessity of the federal bureaucracy, right? They were just fighting over its character. Yep. Right? They were fighting over, you know, its permanence. And so they argue that, you know, the bureaucracy should serve the people. It should be responsive. It shouldn't be burdensome, right? You shouldn't have to fill out mountains of paperwork to get, you know, any sort of benefits. You know, and it should be, you know, responsive to a collective will, right? It should be universal, right? Those are the main tenets of their, you know, working critique of their relationship with these different federal agencies that I discuss. And, you know, we should take a lesson from that.
Indeed. Dale Kretz, visiting assistant professor of history, University of California, Santa Barbara, author of Administrating Freedom, The State of Emancipation After the Freedmen's Bureau. Thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming on. Fascinating stuff. I love talking about Reconstruction, and it's a great birthday present. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Sam. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you.
Anytime.
All right, folks, going to head into the fun. And I should say, we're going to put a link, obviously, to Administrating Freedom at majority.fm and on the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help the show survive and thrive, you also get the free half, free of commercials, and then you get a fun half, which is often fun.
It's fun.
Super fun. Believe me. Also, don't forget Just Coffee. .coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. But right now, I believe they're still having their 30% off sale. So you just go there. You don't even need the coupon code, but put it into their device anyways. Just so that they know where you come from. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Emma, I don't even care because the Pats lost. And well, it was a bummer because Saul got to watch the game because there was no school on Friday.
That was the best game of the
Well, the best game of the season probably against the Jets. But
no, I mean just of the day. Oh, of I'm the joking. Day. Yeah, I know you're joking.
What's happening on ESPN?
Yeah. So we are gonna be talking about the Thanksgiving slate of games, plus Jerry Jones being photographed at a protesting integration, allegedly, one of the most important owners in the NFL, what that says. Also, just some jarring statistics about Russell Wilson's downfall and more. We'll be talking about that on youtube.com/ESVN show today. That's where the stream will be at 4 p.m.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media Enterprise?
In Matlack Media, we have in talk with Brandon Sutton. Me, David, and Brandon talked about the Tucker Carlson original documentary on Blake Masters, who is a loser. And
what does that guy go do now? Works for Peter Thiel again?
It's funny. I just be, right? He liked Matt Walsh had this tweet about so you know the. A shooter comes out and says they're non-binary, and now the story disappears. which is just dumb. Like, that's their defense against a hate crime. Probably bullshit. But Blake Masters liked that tweet, so he's just liking Matt Walsh tweets now. And it's funny. Yeah. It's funny to me, like, Blake Masters, as we talked about with Brandon, like, he couldn't fully commit to, like, 2000 Mules style stop the steal sort of, like, this election was stolen. He tried to pretend he was by saying, you know, big tech censorship in the Hunter Biden story.
Right.
So, but he could never pull the trigger, and Trump was pissed at him. But he also, like, spends his time liking dumb crap from Matt Walsh. So, well, it's like, you're too, like, you're not in the sauce enough to, like, campaign effectively.
But I think he's a true believer. I think he's a true believer when it comes to this sort of, like, fundamentalist sort of worldview.
Right.
And he's just, like, too much of a numbers guy to go, like, well, I believe in systems and processes.
Which is the worst of both worlds.
From an electoral standpoint, yes.
From, like, a hangout standpoint.
Right, exactly.
It's like a psychological well-being standpoint. Right.
God, can you imagine that? I mean, he must have a circle of friends. There must be people who hang out and
drink beers with him. I mean,
he supposedly has a family. That's what I would be spending my time on. But I guess just reading Matt Walsh tweets is...
Yeah, I mean, that's the way that you learn to deal with your family. Folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. We have gotten tremendously positive feedback on the new app. And if you have an iPhone, go get the new app. Do yourself a big favor today for free. Go to majorityapp.com. If you don't have an iPhone, go pick up the app anyways, because the Android version is going to come soon. Because once you build it out and you know what you're doing with it in terms of, like, the UI, as we call it, the user interface, coding the back end for an Android app, it's not that hard. Now, of course, I have absolutely no capacity to code and no idea what I'm talking about, but I'm perfectly willing to... set Kyle up to do that.
Yeah, right.
It's like I'm like the kid on the playground who's got a friend who's really big and goes up picking fights and just says, like, you can't take him.
Right.
And that's what I'm doing with that.
Kind of. Essentially.
No, that's exactly what I'm doing. Except for, like, on the coding level. So check it out. Majorityapp.com. Also, AM Quickie. You get all the news you can use every day in your email box Corey and Jack. So check it out. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the breaks.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Hey,
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
Pussy, 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 pussy.